following are comments on Shakespeare's Hamlet, Act 3. Oh, what a noble mind is here o'erthrown. Hamlet first talks himself through his to be or not to be soliloquy, and then crushes Ophelia's heart with his get thee to a nunnery refrain. In Act 3, Scene 1, Claudius tells Rosencrantz and Guildenstern to encourage the players who have come to Elsinore. Act 3, Scene 1, lines 26 through 27. Perhaps some entertainment will draw out the reason for Hamlet's eccentric behavior. He and Polonius will hide and listen to Hamlet talk with Ophelia. Act 3, Scene 1, lines 42 through 43. But first, Hamlet speaks his famous to be or not to be soliloquy. In it, he asks whether those who are frustrated with life, like him, would do best to continue to bear the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, quote-unquote, the various blows and insults life throws at one, or whether it is better to extinguish one's consciousness by suicide if no other eventuality renders it unnecessary. The prince is drawn to the latter course, but any such resolution is blunted by the soliloquy's other key point. Our ignorance of what comes after death keeps us from acting, and thus, quote-unquote, enterprises of great pitch and moment, with this regard their currents turn awry, and lose the name of action. Act 3, Scene 1, lines 85 through 87. Hamlet's wild words to Ophelia concern mainly the impossibility of maintaining virtue in a corrupt world. The expression, get thee to a nunnery, is almost always glossed with a nod to the fact that the word nunnery was Elizabethan slang for house of prostitution. Act 3, Scene 1, line 119. But here, the intended meaning is probably just as it sounds. Ophelia should seek shelter in a convent to escape any and all, quote-unquote, errant knaves. Hamlet falsely denies any past relationship with her, saying, quote-unquote, I loved you not. Act 3, Scene 1, lines 116 through 117. Then, ominously, he asks her where her father is. Act 3, Scene 1, line 127. Soon, Hamlet seems to lose his composure, quote-unquote, I say we will have no more marriage. Those that are married already, all but one shall live. Act 3, Scene 1, lines 143 through 145. Claudius, who along with Polonius is listening to the whole conversation, gathers that Hamlet's disturbed state is, quote-unquote, not like madness. The prince's, quote-unquote, melancholy, says Claudius, quote-unquote, sits on brood over something still darker. Act 3, Scene 1, lines 161 through 162. As for Ophelia, her meeting with Hamlet is devastating to her well-being. She weeps and cries out, quote-unquote, oh, what a noble mind is here o'erthrown. Act 3, Scene 1, line 147. To hold, as 'twere, the mirror up to nature, Hamlet discusses drama theory with the players, and then he and Horatio observe Claudius as he watches The Murder of Gonzago and a dumb show. Spooked, Claudius calls for light and angrily departs. In Act 3, Scene 2, Hamlet admonishes the players about their craft. His key bits of advice are that they, quote-unquote, o'erstep not the modesty of nature, and make certain, quote-unquote, to hold as 'twere the mirror up to nature, to show virtue her feature, scorn her own image, and the very age and body of the time his form and pressure. Act 3, Scene 2, lines 17 through 18, and lines 20 through 22. Hamlet's remark is similar to the moral statements of Samuel Johnson about art. Actors should display virtue as it is, and compel vice to confront itself head-on. See On Fiction in The Rambler No. 4, 1750. Quote-unquote, vice, for vice is necessary to be shown, should always discussed. Hamlet's mirror metaphor does not ratify the neoclassical claim that spectators are fooled into taking what they see on the stage for reality. To gaze into a mirror is to know in a heightened way that one is looking at a representation, not the thing itself. Still, a representation can refer us to real or true things. Hamlet means to do just that. Showing and then speaking Claudius's sin should make its effects register on his face. He will be holding a mirror up to the king's tortured conscience. Act 3, Scene 2, lines 70 through 79 inclusive. A dumb show starts things off. Act 3, Scene 2, lines 122 and following. Stage directions. This eerie scene shows Claudius the essence of what he has done, and so it primes his imagination and conscience for the blows still to come from the talky version. We might even say that this strange, silent presentation speaks to Claudius in a direct, intimate way that it couldn't to anyone else. Next comes a brief prologue asking for the audience's patience. Then, the player king and queen preview the plot, uttering words that with damning precision hit upon what Hamlet himself must consider the guilty consciences of both Claudius and Gertrude. The player king intimates that he may die soon and wishes that his queen may find another faithful husband. The player queen's shocking reply is, quote unquote, "None wed the second, but who killed the first." In almost proverbial form, implicating herself in her husband's death. Act 3, Scene 2, line 164. The player king offers his queen some worldly wisdom. Once he is dead, her resolution will fade. Quote unquote, "So think thou wilt no second husband wed, but die thy thoughts when thy first lord is dead." Act 3, Scene 2, lines 198 through 199. The passions are not things we can will to remain constant. They are subject to circumstance, to fate, and to the needs of the body. Claudius's annoyance now shows. He asks Hamlet, quote unquote, "Have you heard the argument? Is there no offense in it?" Act 3, Scene 2, line 216. Hamlet says, quote unquote, "No, no, they do but jest, poison and jest. No offense in the world." Act 3, Scene 2, lines 217 through 218. Gertrude's opinion is, quote unquote, "The lady doth protest too much, methinks." Act 3, Scene 2, line 214. That's a point easily re-aimed at Claudius, whose mental stability, it's fair to posit, depends on repressing consciousness of his conduct. Hamlet is sharp with Ophelia throughout Act 3, Scene 2. He seems to bait her and accuse her of lewdness, effectively blaming her for Gertrude's failings. This treatment of Ophelia is another twist of the knife by Hamlet into her already wounded soul. Ophelia is not to blame for obeying her father's scheme to use her as bait, but Hamlet spreads guilt all around instead of restricting it to Claudius. The ghost told Hamlet not to taint his mind against Gertrude, but he really should have added Ophelia. Still, the blame is strongly affixed to Claudius when in the mousetrap, quote unquote, one Lucianus, nephew to the king, shows up and, quote unquote, pours the poison in the player king's ears. Act 3, Scene 2, line 226. Claudius says, quote unquote, "Give me some light, away," and abruptly exits. Act 3, Scene 2, line 249. It seems that Hamlet's prior mention of poisoning has primed Claudius for this sight and increased his shock and feeling of violation. Hamlet's layered iterations of the king's terrible sin have driven him to a fearful rage, and this is the last straw. Hamlet and Horatio agree that Claudius's behavior is revealing. Horatio's, quote unquote, "I did very well note him," may be taken as confirmation of guilt. Act 3, Scene 2, line 269. Hamlet's anger turns first towards Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, whom he disabuses of any hope that they may, quote-unquote, play upon him. Act 3, Scene 2, line 344. His anger turns next to Gertrude, who is perhaps the main target of the scene, so savage is Hamlet's portrayal of her alleged role in Hamlet Sr.'s death. The prince's rejection of being an instrument is interesting. He wants to take control. With respect to Gertrude, Hamlet's words are exceptionally harsh. He says, quote unquote, "Now could I drink hot blood and do such business as the bitter day would quake to look on." Act 3, Scene 2, lines 361 through 363. This violent thought seems to be for Claudius, but it may also apply to Gertrude, since Hamlet follows it with, quote unquote, "Let me be cruel, not unnatural. I will speak daggers to her, but use none." Act 3, Scene 2, lines 366 through 367. "My words fly up, my thoughts remain below." Claudius makes a desperate attempt to salvage his soul by prayer, and Hamlet won't risk sending him to heaven as he prays. Revenge can wait. In Act 3, Scene 3, the king has decided that Hamlet must be trundled off to England, and Rosencrantz says to Claudius, quote unquote, "The cease of majesty dies not alone, but like a gulf doth draw what's near it with it." Act 3, Scene 3, lines 15 through 17. Guildenstern, too, flatters the king that what he does is necessary to protect the welfare of the state and the people. Quote unquote, "Most holy and religious fear it is to keep those many bodies safe that live and feed upon your majesty." Act 3, Scene 3, lines 8 through 10. No wonder these two time servers end up in a postmodern play by Tom Stoppard. Still, the words of Hamlet's one-time friends must be comforting to Claudius, since the political realm itself is like an exoskeleton protecting the usurper king from the ravages of introspection and guilt. Claudius is addicted to the same tyrant's plea of necessity that will later account for the hollowness of Satan's rhetoric in Milton's Paradise Lost. Alone with his tormenting thoughts, Claudius kneels and tries to confront, quote unquote, "the visage of offense." Act 3, Scene 3, line 47. But this hollowed-out, hopeless man won't give up his crown or his queen. It is painful to behold a person in such spiritual distress, even if it's entirely his own fault. It may be that Claudius isn't so much sorry as determined to indulge himself in remorse, or in what Oscar Wilde calls, in The Picture of Dorian Gray, Chapter 8, the quote-unquote luxury of self-reproach. Predictably, the results of Claudius's prayer are nil, quote-unquote, "My words fly up, my thoughts remain below. Words without thoughts never to heaven go." Act 3, Scene 3, lines 97 through 98. Before the king arrives at this conclusion, Hamlet reveals his unchristian desire that Claudius's soul at death, quote-unquote, "may be as damned and black as hell whereto it goes." Act 3, Scene 3, lines 94 through 95. That sounds like something the revenger in a Senecan tragedy would say. In any case, the ineffectuality of Claudius's prayer relieves Hamlet of the need to contrive such an outcome. "Heaven hath pleased it so," ellipsis, "that I must be their scourge and minister." Hamlet menaces Gertrude and kills the concealed Polonius, thinking him to be the king. Claudius is duly alarmed. In Act 3, Scene 4, Hamlet soon reaches his mother's chambers and engages with her in all strictness, insisting, quote unquote, "You go not till I set you up a glass where you may see the inmost part of you." Act 3, Scene 4, lines 19 through 20. When Gertrude screams for help, Polonius echoes her cry and pays for that mistake with his life. He is suddenly stabbed to death by Hamlet, who dispatches the meddling counselor with a catchphrase, quote unquote, "Dead for a ducat, dead." Act 3, Scene 4, line 24. The prince goes on to berate Gertrude. Hamlet has little time now for the quote-unquote wretched, rash, intruding fool, Polonius, and he makes Gertrude confront her sinfulness as directly as he made Claudius behold his guilt. Act 3, Scene 4, line 31. Hamlet's efforts succeed without too much trouble, since Gertrude cries out, quote-unquote, "O Hamlet, speak no more. Thou turn'st my very eyes into my soul, and there I see such black and grieved spots as will leave there their tinct." Act 3, Scene 4, lines 88 through 91. Here, Ernest Jones's Freudian Oedipal reading of the play comes into its own. Hamlet imagines his mother in bed with Claudius, where they linger, quote-unquote, "honeying and making love over the nasty sty." Act 3, Scene 4, lines 92 through 94. The ghost steps in to admonish him about his almost blunted purpose, quote-unquote, of taking revenge against Claudius. Act 3, Scene 4, line 110. Gertrude is unable to see the ghost, which must only increase her terror, since her son seems utterly mad. For Polonius, Hamlet clearly feels some remorse, but it is quickly smoothed over with philosophizing. Quote unquote, "For this same Lord I do repent, but heaven hath pleased it so to punish me with this, and this with me, that I must be their scourge and minister." Act 3, Scene 4, lines 173 through 176. Hamlet tells Gertrude not to let on that he's not exactly insane, and he confides in her about his plans to launch a counterattack against Claudius and his agents. Knowing he cannot trust Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, who are the king's agents, the prince says, quote-unquote, "Let it work, for 'tis the sport to have the enginer hoist with his own petard. And it shall go hard, but I will delve 1 yard below their minds and blow them at the moon." Act 3, Scene 4, lines 206 through 210. This is an odd exclamation, since at this point, Hamlet should know only that he's being marshaled to knavery, quote-unquote. Act 3, Scene 4, line 206. Claudius enters after Hamlet's encounter with Gertrude, and he is now, by his own admission to the queen, quote-unquote, "full of discord and dismay." Act 3, Scene 4, line 263. He knows that Hamlet's sword was meant for him, and he must try to clean up the domestic political damage Hamlet has done in killing Polonius. "The king is a thing of nothing." By his madcap words and behavior, Hamlet makes it clear to Claudius that he presents a threat to him. In Act 3, Scene 5, Hamlet calls Rosencrantz a sponge who, quote-unquote, soaks up the king's countenance, his rewards, his authorities. Act 3, Scene 5, line 12 and lines 14 through 16. As for Claudius, well, quote-unquote, "the king is a thing," ellipsis, "of nothing," says Hamlet. Act 3, Scene 5, line 27 and line 29. His remark that, quote-unquote, "the body is with the king, but the king is not with the body," refers in part to Polonius's corpse, but it also seems to refer to the political doctrine that the king has both an imperishable civil or corporate body and a natural or mortal one. Act 3, Scene 5, lines 26 through 27. Everyone knows the declaration that encapsulates this doctrine. "The king is dead. Long live the king." For a full exploration of the doctrine, see Ernst Kantorowicz's 1957 book, The King's Two Bodies, A Study in Medieval Political Theology. Hamlet may thus be making an oblique threat. Men such as Claudius, who fetishize power and royal dignity, seem to confound the two bodies and lose perspective on their limitations, as well as their responsibilities to fellow human beings, mortals all. Like the hectic in my blood, he rages. Claudius becomes alarmed by Hamlet's menacing posture and language and decides in secret to have the prince executed upon his arrival in England. In Act 3, Scene 6, Claudius, talking to Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, lays out the perilous state he's in. Quote unquote, diseases desperate grown by desperate appliance are relieved or not at all. Act 3, Scene 6, lines 9 through 11. Then follows Hamlet's quizzical but menacing conversation with the king, which culminates in the prince's gloriously brutal truth that, quote unquote, a man may fish with the worm that hath ate of a king, and eat of the fish that hath fed of that worm. Since that's so, Hamlet reasons, quote unquote, a king may go a progress through the guts of a beggar. So, what's for dinner, Claudius? Act 3, Scene 6, lines 26 through 27, and lines 29 through 30. Claudius, Hamlet's memento mori figure implies, has prioritized the adornment and aggrandizing of a decaying mortal body that is easily reduced by natural process to a thing, and ultimately to nothing. That is what he has traded his soul for. Hamlet also calls Claudius, quote-unquote, dear mother, a slip-up that seems both bizarre and yet earnest, since the prince has become obsessed with his mother Gertrude and her guilt with respect to Hamlet Sr. Act 3, Scene 6, line 47. To say the least, Claudius is disturbed by Hamlet's presence, and he now commits internally to the young man's present death, quote-unquote, upon his debarkation onto English soil. Act 3, Scene 6, line 62. Like all such murderous villains, the usurper king seeks security, quote unquote, till I know 'tis done, howe'er my haps, my joys will ne'er begin. Act 3, Scene 6, lines 64 through 65. What good is it to be a monarch after all, if you must constantly look over your shoulder to make sure those you've injured don't take away what you traded your very soul to gain? Macbeth and Richard III would certainly empathize, if, of course, they were capable of empathy. Thanks for listening. This audio lecture was recorded on Saturday, February 7th, 2026. The foregoing material is copyright 2026 by Alfred J. Drake. For quotations, I have relied on the Norton Shakespeare 3rd edition, 4-volume genre-based format.